Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Hollywood with right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host with the most, Nikki Carulla. We have a very special guest today in the studio for our pandemic social distancing episode. We have mixing engineer, recording wizard, Buck Snow. Say hello, Buck. How are you, man?
Hello. I'm doing great.
So tell me, where did you grow up, man?
I grew up in Florida.
What city?
Near Tampa, in a city called Clearwater.
Okay, I know Clearwater. The recording school is out there?
No, that's a little bit further north. You're talking about Full Sail?
Yeah, Full Sail. Yeah, that's right.
That's kind of near Orlando.
Okay. All right. I know Tampa. Tampa's really, really humid, man. So you must love this dry climate out here.
I do.
They're getting some pretty hot heat these days.
Yep. And it's just starting to be hurricane season.
Oh, man. So let me ask you this. You were growing up in Tampa. Did you ever listen to records? What was the moment of Zen that made you want to become an engineer, want to, you know, be involved with music?
I think I wanted to be involved in music for a long time. I remember the first CD that I bought was Green Day Dookie.
Nice. That's a classic.
Yep. And I remember listening to that and just, you know, really being like, you know, this is what I want to create. And then at the time, one of my friends, his dad had a recording studio.
Oh, wow.
And after school, we would go hang out in it while we waited for his dad to finish work and then, you know, go over to my friend's house and play video games and stuff. But so that was like where I first went into a studio and I went, oh, wow, this is a job. This is a thing.
And did you they were probably using analog tape, I'm sure, with maybe some DAT as well.
I think at that time they were using AT-ATs.
Okay. Yeah. So were you getting familiar and asking questions, or were you just kind of like enamored with the whole process of just like, oh my God, this is what you can do in a studio?
I think it wasn't even like what you can do in a studio. It was just like studios exist. And actually, I think probably the first recording experience I had was for like a school Halloween project, you know, haunted house in the school or something. We recorded a bunch of like scary sounds, you know, and, you know, we were just sitting in this booth with headphones, you know, doing like coyote howls and, you know, different weird noises and banging two metal rods together. But the guy put lots of reverb on it and, you know, had these, he also did like ambient music score and stuff like that. So he, you know, out of just us two little kids sitting in this booth, he created this whole kind of soundscape. So that I guess was the moment where I went, wow, there's really a creation here that you can do just in the studio.
How old were you when that happened?
11 maybe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
See, I feel like, you know, with Malcolm Blackwell, I think that's his name, with his book Outliers, he always says there's a reason when things are just around that you end up getting enamored with, like having a studio nearby. And, you know, for me, it was growing up in LA, I was in studios recording stuff as a kid. Yeah. And I was just enamored with just the whole process of it because it was just a magical place to be around. So you must have kind of had that experience just being around all the tools. Yeah. And just seeing how they can manipulate sound and seeing how that could, like, you know, expand your imagination. Was he showing you other stuff that he was doing with ambient music?
A little bit. I mean, again, I was very young. He put a guitar in our hands and was like, hey, so you want to learn how to play guitar? You know, you put your fingers here and that's an E chord. And if you put your fingers here, then, you know, So from there, me and my friends started playing guitar. And I had a couple other friends that played guitar. And we, you know, by the time I was 14, we started a band.
Awesome. What kind of music was it?
It was really heavy stuff like Korn, Limp Bizkit, Pantera. Those were the guys we were listening to at that time.
So you were playing guitar?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Do you still play guitar?
Not really. I mean, I'll pick it up from time to time, but I
never give it up, man. Never give it up.
I won't say that I've given it up, but I've invested most of my time into engineering, and that's kind of paid off.
You know, it's funny because Green Day Dookie was one of my favorite records. I actually got it when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And I just remember being blown away with the sonic qualities of it because it was very current. You know, like I was used to listening to like Jimi Hendrix and even Nirvana and some of those. But when Green Day Dookie came out, it was like, man, this is like a really new sound and it's a really current sound. And it sounds like nothing that's been done before, just with the size of the drums, how big the guitars were. And funny story for me, when I did my first record, my first full length, Green Day was in the studio that I was looking at. They weren't there, but all their gear was there. Right. So I was just, I remember walking through and like seeing, I remember the drums, there were probably like 50 drums.
Yeah.
And 50 snares. And they're all like out like sun rays, you know, like underneath the drum throne. And I was just like, this is awesome that they even do recordings like this, because who has that kind of time to do that? But Green Day did. Yep. They had that much time to figure out what kind of snare, what kind of, you know, vibe and feel. So it was like full circle. What was the so you were in the band, did you make a record at the studio or did you record with the band?
No, the band was created with a different group of friends. By that time I was hanging out with a different group of friends and not with the friend who had the studio. But I had been talking to him a bit, and like after I finished high school, I was going to go do an internship there, and you know, that was my plan originally. But yeah, so the band that I was in, we got one of those Tascam 4-track cassette recorders.
Yeah, I had the same one, man.
Yeah, and I just remember like recording a demo, and I had so much fun playing around with mic position and recording and, you know, adjusting the levels and EQ and everything like that, that I had way more fun doing that than I did playing guitar or practicing guitar. I was really bad. I was really bad at practicing guitar. You know, my guitar teacher definitely scolded me a lot on that point.
Well, it's tough because, you know, I studied a little bit in the beginning. And if you're not like completely inspired by the instrument, or even what you're learning.
Yeah.
And it's easy to, you know, I actually stopped taking lessons just because I was like, you know what, I'm just going to write and play and then keep learning chords. And I still take that approach when I'm playing and writing now, because it's like, if it's not fun, exciting and challenging,
yeah,
it keeps me at it, then it's like, what's the point? But that 4-track, man, I'm sure you were blown away with it like I was, because I remember just being so impressed that you could record overdubs.
Yeah,
and you could do harmonies, and you could make them sound good. I remember the mixes I did on that little 4-track were super decent, and I've been trying to find some of those original tapes for years. Do you still have any of those original tapes?
I might have one or two.
So it was like the first, you know, foot in the door for you to kind of like learn the balancing act of mixes and EQ.
Yeah.
Did you like listen to records in a different way after you started toying with all that stuff?
Oh yeah. Then I was really picking out things. And I think at that time I was really into Korn and Limp Bizkit. And I remember when Limp Bizkit's second album came out, maybe it was Significant Other. Just the clarity of those mixes and all the details. I mean, I just remember listening with headphones and, you know, for days on end, trying to pick out all the different instruments and everything that was happening in those mixes.
Do you ever go back to those records that first started it out for you? Like the,
I do. I just recently listened to that Limp Bizkit record again. And one of those songs just has the most incredible drum sound that I've ever heard. I haven't yet heard. Like This,
okay.
I think that's the name of the song. It just starts out with just drums.
Well, the reason I ask is I find when I listen to older records that I used to love, that I hear more things in those records than I ever did before. Like, it was like so overwhelming when I'd first listened to those records, and now that I hear and know how to do some of those tricks, I'm hearing the panning, I'm hearing like the EQ. What I always fight this when I mix a record, but it's like what I, my memory of the mix versus the actual mix is also very different. Do you find that when you listen to old stuff now that you know how to do a lot of this?
I do, more of just that I hear a lot more in them. I don't quite hear them differently. Like it's not generally like, oh, wow, this actually sounds bad or anything like that. It's more like, oh my God, what were they doing with the guitars there? You know, really, was that how they did the drums? Like things like that.
Yeah, you know, I find, I always think everything is up the middle when you're first listening to stuff.
Right.
And then you start getting into the details and you're like, oh, the guitars are on the left or the drums are partially on the in the middle and some of it's to the right or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
So I also find that, you know, it's not so much mistakes that, that I look for or anything like that, but it's more like, you know, when I listen to Led Zeppelin, I love Led Zeppelin. They're known for drums.
Yeah.
When I listen to their drum sounds versus current records, their drums are actually really small compared to current records.
Yeah.
But they have this, you know, folklore of having the biggest drum sound. And, you know, it's helped me understand, oh, my perception has changed of the songs as I get better at recording and listening for certain things. You know what I mean?
For sure.
So did you make a record with this band that you're in high school or no?
No, we did a couple demos and we split up before we got any real traction.
And then, so after high school, how did you know, where did you pursue recording?
I was originally going to do an internship at the studio and I was also looking at going to Full Sail to do an education. And then I got offered a job as an internship basically and moved out to Los Angeles to help renovate and restart a studio that this was Mad Hatter Studios.
Oh yeah.
It was owned by Chick and then it was bought by somebody else and renovated and like restarted. So I was there for that and that's really where I got my start.
Is that where you met Brian? Because that's how that the only time I went there, Brian Vibritz, he brought me into that studio and gave me a whole tour and I was so impressed with that place.
Yeah.
So crazy. It's awesome.
Yeah.
So Chick doesn't own it now?
Correct.
Oh, he sold it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Great studio.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You know, it's crazy because it's like when those rooms were in their heyday, you know, the amount of music that was running through those places is crazy. And now, you know, I always wish I owned one of those studios because, you know, even financially, it's not the best investment because their home studios have taken over and everything. But just having that kind of gear, like at your disposal all the time, I mean, there's a difference, you know. I always find that, you know, I love doing home recording, but going into a studio that has history and has this crazy amount of gear, it puts you in a different frame of reference and it also puts you in a different working atmosphere. Explain what that's like for you and how you kind of evolved with working at Mad Hatter and other studios.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you're in a studio, it's kind of like a sacred temple, you know, it's like everything else just kind of gets shut out and your attention is just on, you know, what you're recording.
Right.
So it really raises your game. You know, let's say you got five guys who are all tracking at the same time. Everybody's relying on everybody else to just have their attention on what they're doing. And so with that, I mean, I remember after the renovations and stuff, Chick came back to record an album there and he had blocked out, I think, 3 weeks to record.
Wow.
And because the environment was just so aesthetic, so beautiful, and, you know, everything was taken care of, you know, they're like, oh, we're getting hungry. And, you know, we'd have runners bring in the food and everything. So it was just all they had to worry about was making their music. And I think we tracked all of the songs in 10 days.
Wow.
You know, so half the time than was expected. And so much so that he recorded another 3 bonus songs for the album. So it was just like, that's a great example of how being in the studio causes you to focus and create, you know, music where there's this synergy between everybody that you don't get when you're separated and all in your bedroom and, you know, you're interrupted by the Amazon guy delivering a package. And
right. And you know what? Like, Chicory is like one of the jazz legends of all time.
Yeah.
You know, when you were working with them, tell me what was one of the coolest moments of you just like being in the room? Because I know with artists like that at that caliber, you're hearing things that are just mind blowing and you're just trying to like maintain composure and, you know, do the gig. But it's also like there's a part of it where it's like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm here. Explain one of those moments that you have with Chick Corea.
I think it was when we were recording a band, an album with the Electric Band, and Dave Weckl was playing, and I'd always loved and appreciated drums, but watching him play and listening to him play was just a completely different experience. And you know, they were playing stuff, and the improvisation between them and the interplay, and you know, each take was like a totally different performance. It was a totally different song pretty much because of their different solos and everything like that. So getting to experience that, and I don't know, it just like puts you in an out of body experience to just be there and hearing that as it's being created.
It's also like you're in a room full of Jedis, you know what I mean? It's like they just know how to make things sound great no matter what they're playing and when they're playing. I always marvel at great musicians because it's like the best musicians make it look so easy. So I'm sure he made it look easy while you guys were working together. Did you do anything that was crazy recording wise? Did you mic the drums in a different way, or did you, you know, mic the piano in a strange way that was, you know, peculiar? Because you know how it is. It's like there are go-tos always when you're recording, but then there's always something that you want to innovate and try to get better at. I always find with every record, there's some part of the process where it's like, it's either a letting go or using a new piece of gear or kind of, you know, using a different approach to get a better result in some way.
Yeah, I think it was fairly straightforward. I think the really unique thing on that album was the stuff that he did after the basic tracking. So we recorded the basic tracks, and then he went through and he did keyboard overdubs, and he did, he had a producer that he was working with who did like effects and stuff. So like there was one song that he did, which was a piano solo, but he put in these different effects in like reverse piano notes and things like that, which made it like really hauntingly futuristic while still just being a single piano.
There was
no like pads or anything, but it created this whole atmosphere with these textured reverbs and, you know, fun stuff like that.
Awesome. Well, let's hear something that you worked on. What do you want to play first?
Let's see. I think we could play the song from Teague. This is a guy that I was working with recently, a really, really interesting kind of, I guess, American folk music. This was a great example, kind of since we're talking about quarantine days and stuff like that. He had tracked a long time ago, drums and stuff, but then all the vocals and guitars and stuff were overdubbed in, you know, his house in the other people's bedrooms and stuff like that. So it's just a great track to show how you can take natural recordings and really make them into a beautiful harmonies and amazing soundscape.
All right, here it comes.
All the thoughts you write. sit beside all the thoughts you write. I will do my best, dear, to make every dream you have appear. Our lives about to start with words of heart.
Cool, man.
Thank you.
It's very Simon and Garfunkel. It's very it's got like that kind of a road trip kind of song. Road trip kind of vibe. So did he do all the harmonies, or was it two guys and a girl doing the top part?
It was him and two girls that were doing all the vocals.
Sounded great. And where is he from? Is he from the US?
He's from Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. Sounded great. Sounded really cool. Yeah. So let me ask you this. Like, how was your approach when you got the track? Did you take anything out that he recorded that you didn't think worked? Or did you kind of like mix the things that he wanted that were all there? What was your approach with this mix?
I mean, generally, I always just try to start with everything that the person has put in and try to make everything work. I'll give everything a shot before I, you know, decide that, you know, maybe this is too much or anything like that. And generally, I do get everything into the mix, sitting in a way that, you know, complements each other. But yeah, I kind of did a mix of it. And actually, I'm just remembering that on this song, I kind of gave myself a challenge for it and was mixing it entirely with just one set of plugins.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, so it was mixed completely with Isotope plugins.
And did you do that just as a different way of approach to just make everything kind of fit nicely, or was it just...
It was kind of, a challenge, you know, for myself. Also, I had been talking with Isotope and stuff, and I said, hey, if I did a song that showcased that, you know, everything can be done with just your plugins, would you be interested? And they're like, yeah, totally. So... it was interesting because, you know, you probably have your favorite guitars and things like that, which you go to get certain sounds.
Yeah.
So I've got my certain effects and plugins that I use for certain things. So then I had to go, okay, well, what plugin do they have that can create that same sound? And
oh, that's a challenge.
It was, but it was fun because, I always try to put a challenge into everything. And it also, it got me thinking about his music in a slightly different way, which I might not have gone to, and like really kind of trying to go for like a 70s sort of vibey record, but still being modern and, you know, full range.
It totally has the vibe of Two of Us from Let It Be by the Beatles.
Yeah.
And it totally has the vibe of The Boxer by Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah,
I could totally hear those influences and some modern influences too that are more European, but you could definitely tell that they love those songwriters and those kind of harmonies. Everly Brothers, you know, Righteous Brothers, all that stuff that kind of has some of that classic harmony. So what was one of the biggest obstacles that you had mixing this song? Was it, you know, in the vocals? Was it in the drums, making sure they drive? Was it just in balancing everything, EQ?
I think it was in the, you know, getting the drums to drive along through the whole thing, and, but not be overbearing, because the harmonies are really the delicate balance and the, you know, what should be the center point. But the bass and drums, they have to provide that energy throughout. And then it goes to that bridge, which gets huge. And that is like, you know, very orchestral and lots of harmonies. And it, you know, is the kind of thing where you want everything swimming around your head and it's just like gigantic. And then it comes back to the last chorus and it can't lose energy, but it comes back to, you know, just a simple, what, 4 or 5 piece band then. Right. So that was probably the biggest challenge, was to make it expand after that big bridge. And that was what he had been having the most trouble with in the arranging of it and, you know, the mix that he was trying to do with it. And I figured out how to really nail that home so that it still lifts until the very end.
I'm going to ask you a gear question, because I love talking to engineers. Yep. What do you mix on? What speakers, what monitors, what are your references for headphones?
For speakers, I use JBL 708Ps. I found them to be incredibly accurate. And, you know, besides like the closest other monitors that I would say are like probably $100,000. So for
me, JBL, these are JBLs right here. Yep. These are JBL LSR, I think 128Ps.
Yes, I think so. The 708Ps, I think, are just the new generation of what those are.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they've got digital correction on them, so you can EQ the actual monitor for the room if you need to. You don't need
outboard
EQ and stuff. And they're also really great for doing film work, because I do film work and I do music work. So it was a monitor which I felt I could mix just as well for both areas.
Well, you won me over with JBL. That was kind of a trick question, because I think JBLs are the best speakers in they're the best speakers in the business.
I think so too, because the thing for me is that they're not hyped in any one area. They're very just neutral and flat, and what you hear on them is what you get. And you, when you make it sound great on that, it's going to sound great on Genelecs. It's going to sound great on KRKs. It's going to sound great on NS10s. It doesn't
totally work. Totally agree. I actually feel like a lot of engineers use Genelecs, NS10s, KRKs, all of those as references. When I'm like, yo, the JBLs are going to sound better. You're going to get everything more that you want out of those. And when they transfer to those, it's still going to sound every bit as good, if not better.
I know. How many times have you done a mix on Genelecs and you're like, it sounds great. And then you go listen on some other monitor and you're like, oh, did we really?
Actually, I don't like Genelecs. I don't like NS10s for that reason.
Me too.
I don't like KRKs either. It's like, and when, you know, people use a lot of they've become industry standards, mostly because of the price point and because everybody likes, you know, kind of having something to reference. Yeah. But man, I got JBLs. What I listen to when I work are JBLs, and then what I listen to finished product, that those are what's connected to my record player, my sound system. So like nothing finished. Only finished stuff goes on those, and then I have another set of JBLs that I mix on, because if I can make it sound good here, I know it's going to sound good there. So it's definitely like this like fine balance of how you're going to make it sound, you know, accessible. It's going to have power and drive and balance and EQ and nuance. Then I think that's what all those speakers. What about headphones? What do you use for headphones?
I like the Sony MDR-7506s. That's kind of a standard. I mean, it's a studio standard. But actually, one of the earlier models of almost the same headphones, which is the MDR-V6. These guys.
Yep. I have two sets of those. And I actually also have the MDR-V700. Which is a DJ. It's a DJ headphone, and really, it's for the bass response that I love. I love listening to stuff on that.
Yes,
but I'm still looking for JBL makes headphones, so I'm always like, I need to check out their headphones. I've never checked out their headphones because I'm still looking for the most insane headphones to mix on or to use, because it's such a different ballgame when you listen to a mix on headphones.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that for a second. When you do a mix on headphones mm-hmm. versus monitors, what kind of adjustments or what kind of changes do you feel are the most necessary or the biggest, you know, dramatic changes from one to the other?
I think that what I discovered mixing on headphones, because I've actually mixed quite a lot of stuff on headphones and then taken and listened to speakers. I've found that I have to actually listen quieter than I think on headphones. Generally, what gets messed up is your balances between instruments. You know, the vocal will be too loud or too quiet, and you know, you'll listen on speakers and you'll be like, wow, that guitar is, you know, either way too loud or way too quiet. So I found that actually I have to listen at a lower volume than I kind of feel is comfortable on headphones. And then I can make better decisions about those volumes. And then when I listen on speakers, it translates better.
So you feel like sometimes when you listen on lower volumes, you lose a lot of that mid-range sometimes. Yeah. But I also love just knowing when you hear it on the monitors, it's going to have more of that. So it's like you're listening in a different way using headphones versus monitors. But I find that I'm constantly listening on low volumes on both, listening on high volumes on both, and then just listening on like an almost like middle of the ground, but more softer than middle of the road, mm-hmm. you know, just to find how it's going to translate on all those mixes. And it's like, I feel like when you can hear everything on a mix that you want to hear in a way that either it gives it a presence or it gives it some kind of vibe or showcase, it's like, then it's there. You know what I mean? For you, how do you find that perfect balance of a mix?
Well, I usually start with the mix, you know, not too loud, but just decently loud, like get the vibe, get the energy and kind of get the excitement into the mix. And as I get closer and closer to the mix, I turn it down more and more. So like my final passes of the mix are quite at a low volume. I mean, if somebody else is in the room talking, then I have to tell them to shut up because I can't hear what I'm doing. But really, so because my view is if I hear all the important musical points when it's pretty low, then it's going to translate well anywhere.
Right.
And I'll also like listen to it on laptop speakers at that point and stuff and, you know, make sure the vocals aren't getting lost at any point or anything. Just make sure like, okay, are they the parts that are supposed to give the rhythm, are they still coming through? You know, the main melodies, the little fills, you know, do those still give excitement and energy? So, yeah, I find when it's quiet and all those things are there, then when you turn it up, it's just that much more fun.
Now you have some very cool accomplishments and you've worked with some pretty amazing people besides Chick Corea, Stanley yeah. Clark, Beck, Metallica, The Fray. What record did you do with The Fray, by the way?
I did string recordings for How to Save a Life.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
My band opened for them not last year, the year before, so 2 years ago. So I love that record so much. Yeah. So I was hoping you say that. And I just happened to put that on the Facebook post, How to Save a Life. So it's perfect. Oh, that's crazy. Let me ask you, you also have 7 Grammys.
Yeah.
Is there a Grammy of yours that you are most proud of or excited by? Was it the first one? Is it a record that you really believed in that you knew would go the distance? Tell me about that part of your career.
I think it would be the first Grammy that I got. That was for Chick Corea's album, The Ultimate Adventure. And that was an album that I mixed with Al Schmidt. He did part of the songs, and then I did the rest of the songs. And he also kind of supervised the rest of the songs. But it, so like he kind of set up first, like, okay, this is the general sound that we're going to go for. But then I, you know, did the rest of the album and, you know, probably even had to do a couple of tweaks, you know, by Chick's request on the earlier songs and stuff. But that was the first like real full album that I mixed. So I would say that was, and then that was my first Grammy win. So that one will forever. Yeah.
The stars are colliding there. You know, they're all lining up.
That's right.
That's amazing. Let me ask you this too. So when you're kind of like working in the digital space, do you mm-hmm. mix to analog tape? Have you mixed or recorded in the analog space as well? Like, how do you find, you know, we're getting farther and farther away from that analog thing that I think is so special. I actually just recorded an entire record all with no automation, all analog, all to tape. And it's a different way of listening. Mm-hmm. How do you find a balance of kind of like, you know, using some of the technology that is very current versus the nostalgia and, you know, warmth of analog gear or tape or any kind of, how do you balance both those if you do?
Well, I got started mixing at Mad Hatter Studios, and they had a gorgeous Neve mix board and Studer tape machines and a rack full of outboard gear. So I got started on the top gear, you know, super warm console, you know, mixing to tape, and really kind of learned how that sounds and how records should sound and how those different pieces of equipment, you know, how an LA-2A will contribute that warmth and that grit to an instrument, or an 1176, how it adds bite and attitude. So I really kind of knew how those things were supposed to go. Then, you know, as things have gone more and more digital and stuff like that, like right now, you know, trying to work from home for the whole stay at home thing, you know, I don't have that outboard gear. So it was like, okay, so what can I do all digital inside Pro Tools? And, you know, I've tried all of the different plugins. I found that the Universal Audio plugins really sound like how those analog pieces of gear react. You know, I put an 1176 on and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's exactly how an 1176 sounds, the good and the bad. It sounds just like it.
Right. So you used the actual tools, and the technology's given you the opportunity to use digital versions. And
yeah.
Still be able to capture. That's awesome. That is super awesome. Do you find there's a difference?
I would say that there is. Like, if I had the analog gear, I would go for the analog gear. I think there's a bit of a size, kind of just like a, you know, a mass or something that you can get with analog gear that plugins, especially UAD plugins, they come really close. And maybe unless you're doing a head-to-head AB, you wouldn't even notice.
Most won't notice.
But what I do like is I've found that with working with all digital with plugins and stuff, I can work so much faster. And, you know, I can use, you know, 27 1176s if I want to, you know, where I only had two before. So it's given me a freedom where it's kind of taken away restrictions that I can work much faster and I can actually get to where I want to go better. So it's actually made my mixes better in a way that, because then it's like, I don't know, it's like before with the analog gear, it was like working with heavy cement or something, trying to sculpt. And now I'm working with silly putty. I can just so much quicker, you know, create the sound and the effect that I want.
Yes.
But I've done a lot of looking to find different plugins which give me that kind of depth. And, you know, I wouldn't say analog gear for me is really about the warmth or the smoothness or anything like that, because I can get that with digital really easily. I would say it's more like the size or the weight and the clarity and the depth of space that you can get with analog gear. So I've definitely been very careful in choosing my different plugins in order to create that.
That's awesome. I always feel like when I work in the digital space versus the analog space, I can hit tape way harder than I hit digital. And, you know, whether it's vocals or guitars or whatever. And I kind of like that analog gives you that kind of like punching bag feel where you can really hit it hard and it'll still do what it needs to and sometimes add to the effect of how it should sound so that it becomes what you want it to be, versus sometimes digital, there's an overuse of compression that happens. There's so many variables. It's endless. You have endless tracks. So like even your arrangements, you're like, oh, we can put this everywhere. Whereas analog, you have 24 tracks, you know, most of the time, or 16, depending on the speed. So it's like, you need to choose what's essential. And I feel like part of the process, and, you know, helps and aids the sound in both procedures in different ways. Let's play something else of yours. What do you want to play next?
Sure. Let's play the track by Stephen Ridley. This will follow into what we were just talking about really great.
Okay, perfect. All right, here comes.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who get easily high. No, I don't have much money. No, but God, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. And if I was a sculptor, but then again, no. Or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. Well, I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. You can tell everybody that this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in words how wonderful life. Now you're in the world. Well, excuse me for getting, but these things I do see, I've forgotten if they're green or the blue. Anyway, the thing is, what I really mean is yours are the sweetest eyes I've ever seen. And you can tell everybody that this is your song. And it may be quiet, simple, but oh, now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I've put down in words how wonderful life is and you're don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I've put down in words how wonderful life is. How wonderful life is. How wonderful. You're in the world.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Tell me about your approach with that.
So that was something that he had worked on for a while and he had done a mix with, and he was pretty happy with it, but he wasn't totally satisfied with it. And so I said, okay, yeah, let me take a whack at it. And I mean, it's obviously just vocal and piano, and you know, we're used to listening to full bands and things like that, which have a certain size, you know, they just fill up the speakers in a certain way. So my challenge was really like, how do you take something that's very intimate, but make it big so that it like really engrosses all of your attention while you're listening to it? So I used a lot of the UAD plugins, you know, like Fairchild's and Poltex and, you know, all of these classic big tube pieces of gear to give the piano more weight, to give his vocal more weight, and just, you know, try to also used a lot of their, the Capitol Chambers and I think the Ocean Way Room and stuff like that. So put as much as I could to make it sound real. And, you know, with all those layers of things and stuff, it just, it gets a size and a whole space around it, which the artist listened to it the first time. And he's like, I don't know what you did. I've listened to this song 240 times and whatever magic you put on it just like made it 1,000 times better.
Well, you added, I'll tell you, it's like you hear the dynamics.
Yeah.
And I think you were able to capture and create the dynamics to be a character in the song.
Exactly.
I feel like that's what you want in a mix. You want, like, you know, there's two ways I look at mixes. It's like, okay, can I hear everything that I want to hear that's important or that is the focus of the song in some way? And then there's another part where it's like, do I feel something? And you added that dimension to that, because that recording, you know, it would sound pretty in 1,000 different ways of mixes, but, you know, what made it intimate was the space of the dynamics, the range of the dynamics, how things built, how kind of his voice became a texture, how the piano took over. And a lot of that was in like how you created the dynamics. So tell me what that process was like when you were working on it, like when you were kind of trying to create a lot of momentum. Were you kind of letting things kind of be bigger in sound, or were you kind of like doing the opposite when you were kind of mixing and balancing?
It was kind of both, because there's the technical aspect of he literally goes from a whisper where his vocal cords aren't almost making sound to probably the loudest that he can get without straining his voice. So on just a recording, you'll never hear that quietest part, and that loudest part will just take your head off. So there's the technical of squeezing that down into a dynamic range, which works. But then how do you do it in such a way that it seems like he's going from a whisper to the loudest? You know, I've heard too many things badly mixed where it's so compressed that, you know, the whisper is the loudest part in the song. And then when they get big in the chorus, it gets really tiny. So I had to keep it from doing that. And I did like a lot of tricks, like when he gets much louder, there's a different reverb and it's a longer reverb. So it feels like it's filling up the space more and it's, you know, just like really breaking out there, where when he's really soft, it's a much shorter, smaller reverb. So it feels like he's just whispering in your ear kind of thing.
I love that you did that. Yeah. I mean, it's a great song. It's an Elton John cover. And it's a cool approach to the song, too, because it's very intimate. And, you know, you can't help but be hypnotized by the song because the melody is so great, you know.
Yeah.
But what was really cool is you created the brooding part. Mm-hmm. I think that's what he loved that he may have been missing when he was doing his own mixes, because it can sound, when things sound too perfect, it has no life. I find that the more records and recordings I make, I want things less perfect. Yep. I want things way less compressed. I want the ranges to go over the line and make you feel something for that reaction, rather than it to be safe and not feel something. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Like, I feel like a major philosophy for mine is controlled chaos. Like, I want to control things so that you can hear everything and it's there, but there's got to be like a 5% amount of chaos, of energy, of unpredictability. And that's what keeps your attention, you know. And like, I'll mix things to like 95%. And if I just go to 100% of where everything is exactly in the right place, the mixes get boring.
Yes.
So, and then I'll have to like do a pass where I throw things kind of off kilter and, you know, like add things which are a little bit too loud or a little bit too quiet there or things like that. And that's what creates the excitement. And that's what's so fun about live performances is that unpredictability.
Do you ever leave stuff that some people could deem as mistakes, but it adds to the recording of the song.
Yeah. And if I have something like that, then, you know, anything that I'm putting into a mix is deliberate. There's a purpose for it. So let's say there's a wrong chord played or something like that. I'm either going to duck that out because it doesn't contribute, or let's say it's setting up a bridge and there's an uneasiness and you want it to be like, I don't know what's happening, and then resolve into this beautiful chord afterwards or something. In that case, that mistake, I'll really pump it up and make it, you know, that's the thing, you know, is if it's appropriate to feel out of place and weird and anxious there, then I'll play that up. And that, I think I learned a lot working in film, you know, where you're really telling a story and things like that, and you're putting things in which tell some kind of part of the story. So I'll think of that with these things, you know, if there's like, let's say there's a guitar and it was just horribly recorded and it's very distorted, then it's like, okay, well, let's make it sound like it's coming out of an old radio. You right. know, let's use that to our advantage. Let's make that the thing, you know, rather than trying to hide from it. Because when you hide it and you just tuck it in and stuff, then, you know, it kind of just everything becomes a vanilla mass of
loud and proud, man.
Yeah. So it's either loud and proud or it's going to be taken out.
No, it's really funny. Like, as I make more records, I find that trying to go for perfect is the least goal. It's the farthest thing that I ever wanted. But when I started making records, you're like, this is my chance to make it perfect. Yeah. And you do everything to make it sound perfect. And it's like, now I've kind of go through these like rites of passage with every record or every recording, where it's like, there are things that I leave that I probably wouldn't have left 5 years ago, six years ago, 7 years ago. And I start noticing that some of my favorite records have those same things, whether it's distorted guitars or distorted vocals, or it could be a bass sound that just sounds wonky, or it could be timing stuff sometimes. Yeah. Like, I find like all my favorite records have these kind of like what you would deem, or what anybody would deem, a mistake in that world. But that's what gives it that character and that vibe. And that's what made these records so fantastic. So I start to hear more and more of those with every thing that I want to like let go of in a record. Do you kind of approach that with the same artist to artist, or do you find that some artists that you work with, they are still wanting it to be one way when you're like, okay, do you mix for the client? Do you kind of find a balance between mixing it technically correct versus artistically and creatively correct, whatever that means?
Yeah, I mean, like you were saying, we started out, everything had to be perfect. But the problem that I had with that is nobody could define what perfect is.
Right.
You know, except maybe pitch. But like, even in singing, you swoop up to notes and things like that. So, you know, in timing, well, you're ahead of the pocket, behind it. Like, there is no perfect.
Right.
You know, of course, there's a level of technical expertise, which that, you know, that inspires, you know, some kind of amount of awe and, you know, admiration itself. But no, I go for the emotion. You know, every instrument that I listen to, like if the bass sounds gnarly, I'm like, okay, well, what's that emotion? What's that attitude? And great, let's make that more. You know, so, but I would say I don't have a character. Every artist that I work with, every song is like a different thing, you know, like from that Teague track to that Stephen Ridley track, they were each their own thing of like, okay, what character, what emotion is supposed to come through? What character is going to connect that emotion from the artist to the audience member who's listening to it? So that's everything that I work with, I'm really looking at the emotion. What's the attitude that the instrument is going to give to the end listener?
All right, let's play something. You got one more song, right?
Yep. So this is a gospel track by Stacey Francis. And this is a great example. So those other two were very natural and, you know, organic pieces. And this is a great example of, you know, tons of tracks. And how do you put all of that in and convey that energy and that excitement, which all of those players were contributing to the song?
All right, here it comes. Renan, don't forget to turn off original sound if it's on. We'll be right back.
force, bound together by love, standing as conquerors firmly on the mountain of victory. We stand as one nation, shoulder to shoulder, facing every battle, triumphant in trouble, overcoming every obstacle. Together we stand.
No one is ever done it. Nothing can break our spirit. We're watching every minute. Nurture our desire.
Come on, bring it up now.
What a great arranger, by the way. That's incredible.
Yeah. Slam it.
And I love the key change. The key change, everything elevated, man.
Yeah.
So did you do anything in the mix when that key change happened to just elevate that sound, that sonic sound difference?
Yeah, just kind of made sure, I think, pumped up the bass and, you know, just really made sure that everything is supposed to build up there and get louder and, you know, really make sure to... Yeah, I had to balance it differently because, you know, when things go up, there were certain things which kind of disappeared and stuff. So it really had to make sure that everything stepped up when that key change happens.
It's exciting when you work with gospel musicians because they're just, they're the most talented, you know, it's just like the most insane music and changes and musicianship and singing and just the whole thing. It's just like, you know, you're going to get something exciting when you're working on it.
Oh, absolutely. So much energy. Just such a good vibe.
Well, Buck, you've been a tremendous guest. Thank you for sharing us your secrets. What real quick, before you leave, what Beck song did you work on or what album did you work on?
I worked on several songs on Guero.
Oh, that's one of my favorite records, man. He's like one of my favorite artists.
I know.
Right. Guero is like one of the best records. Very hip hop, very cool. That's amazing, dude. We're going to have to work together at some point, man. We're definitely going to have to work together. So, yeah, man, one more time. Where can people find you if they want to hire you for mixes or for recording? Let everybody know all your social handles and all of that stuff.
Yep, it's all pretty simple. I have a website, www.bucksnowmixing.com. I'm on Instagram. Handle is @BuckSnowMixing. Follow me there and send me a DM. And yeah, I'd love to work with people.
Well, you may get one from me first, man.
For sure, man.
Buck, you've been a tremendous guest. Thank you again for taking the time. We'd love to have you back and keep us posted on everything you're doing in the future, man.
Absolutely, I will.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. Take care, bro.
All right. Good night.